This morning we're going to deal with Thomas Merton's final journey, his Asian pilgrimage. I'm going to be showing a videotape of the film that was made in Bangkok of his last talk. Unfortunately, after we got this videotape here, there is some static on it, but I don't think that'll be too terribly distracting. What I'd like to do is just give a brief introduction to this, show the film, and then we'll talk about the reasons why Merton was interested in Eastern religions and Eastern thought, and why he wanted to go to Asia. Just as a slight introduction to the film, this was the first, in 1968, Merton took the first major trips outside Gethsemane that he had taken in 27 years. He had, of course, gone into Louisville, as I've said, for trips to the doctor and various visits to the hospital. In fact, he had a whole series of weird ailments, heat rash, bursitis. He had constant stomach problems. They tried to make adjustments in the Gethsemane diet, hoping it would help him. They finally discovered in 1967 that he was allergic to lactic acid and had been spending all those years drinking milk and eating cheese. So that after they adjusted that diet, he was getting considerably more meat, which he didn't mind at all, than he had before, in order to get the protein that they had been trying to supply through the milk products. He had made one brief trip to Minnesota in the 50s, and in 1964 he was in New York for 3 days to visit with Daisetsu Teotaro Suzuki, the foremost proponent of Zen to the Western world. When he knew Suzuki was visiting the United States, he had invited him to Gethsemane, but Suzuki was then 94 and didn't feel he could do a lot of traveling on what he thought would be his last trip to the United States. And so Merton asked for and received permission to visit Suzuki in New York. By 1968, however, a couple of things had happened. Merton had been allowed to retire to his hermitage on a 24-hour basis in 1965. In 1967, a chapel and bathroom were added, which meant that he did not have to go back down to the abbey to say mass daily. But the hermitage at Gethsemane was not as isolated as Merton would have liked. The abbot had built it very close to the enclosure, up a little knob in the back of Gethsemane. It's not very far away from the enclosure. And a lot of people were coming to Gethsemane by appointment and without to visit Thomas Merton. Once one knows where the hermitage is, it's very easy to find from the main road leading into the abbey. In fact, a few years ago, a couple came in to the Merton Center, and the man was very interested, and the woman stood there rather prune-faced, severe. And so I thought, well, she's just not interested in Merton. It's the husband who is. And after they'd been there a while, she said, I used to think Thomas Merton was wonderful, but now I don't. And I thought, well, I didn't make any comment because I knew she was going to go on with her story anyway. She had something that she wanted to share, shall we say. And so she said, well, while he was still living, we were at the abbey visiting one time, and we stopped our car on the road and went up through the woods to the hermitage. And we came up, he was chopping wood or something behind him, and we said something, and he whirled around and said, what in the hell do you think you're doing? And she said, I just didn't think a man like Thomas Merton would talk that way. So I didn't bother trying to point out to the woman that any of us in the woods might say that or worse when somebody comes out of the brush and startles us. But it was true that he felt that Gethsemane was no longer as isolated as he would like. It was also true that academic work was beginning on Merton, and a couple of people had already been there to interview him for doctoral dissertations, which was part of the reason he decided that the literary estate should be somewhere other than the Abbey and somewhere other than where he was. And so that's one of the reasons he set up his literary trust. But by 1968, he was anxious to move somewhere else where he could have more isolation. And under the new constitution of the Cistercian order, promulgated after Vatican II, you no longer had to live within the enclosure of your specific monastery in order to be attached to it, which meant that Thomas Merton's pushing for the eremitic life in the Cistercian order had had its effect. This meant that people could live a quarter of a mile, a few miles. Merton's abbot, Dom James Fox, retired in 1968 and retired himself to a hermitage. But his hermitage was 9 miles away from the enclosure on contiguous abbey land. And this was not lost on Merton, that the man who had opposed his being a hermit for years retired to be a hermit when he was no longer abbot. It also wasn't lost on Merton that Dom James's hermitage was a whole lot nicer than his was. In fact, in his journal, he recorded, "Dom James is building a snappy little hermitage 9 miles away in the woods while I got a cinder block structure." And in fact, it was so nice that it was later sold as a hunting lodge to some people. But in any case, he was looking for greater isolation, and he had been invited to visit a number of places. In the spring of 1968, he visited Redwoods, California, where there is a Trappistine monastery, and Christ in the Desert, a Benedictine monastery near Abiquiu, New Mexico. He prepared the journal of that trip for publication. It was not published until 1983, as Woodshore Desert by Peregrine Smith in Salt Lake City. And it's not one of Merton's better journal efforts. In fact, one reviewer called it Wood's Snore Desert. But then he was invited by the Archbishop of Anchorage to visit Alaska to scout out possible places for a hermitage. And he received a number of invitations to visit Asia. An invitation came through for him to meet with the Dalai Lama, who was already in exile at Dharamsala in northern India, having been driven out of Tibet, and an invitation to attend an international conference of Buddhists and Christians on monasticism in Bangkok, where he was to give a major talk. So in the fall of 1968, he left on an Asian pilgrimage, yes, but there also was this other purpose, to scout out places where he might live in greater isolation. He went first back to New Mexico and then to Alaska. I have edited the Alaskan portions of his journal, which will be published in the next year by New Directions, and I think it's a far better journal effort. More like some of his early ones than Woodshore Desert. He has one prose poem where he has listened to the news on the Anchorage radio station, and it's quite amusing. Also in his Alaskan journal, he records the graffiti in the men's room at the Anchorage airport. Reading a great deal during this period of time to prepare for his Asian trip. And then he took off for Asia. So what we'll do now is see this film. This was another one of those ironies in life. Merton had never before been filmed while he was talking or giving an address. We have 632 audio tapes of his lectures and conferences to novices at Gethsemane. but nothing that showed him moving or showed his body language. And this happened the morning of the day he died. As you saw in the documentary, if you saw it, he gave this talk on the morning of December 10th and then was killed when he went back to his room after giving this talk. So we'll see the Bangkok film now. I hope the static won't be terribly disturbing, but at least you'll be able to hear him.
Smith and his Munashiki Idiyam. At the head of these notes, which I am not necessarily following, there is an allusion to a remark that I heard in California before coming to Asia. I was at a meeting to which many revolutionary university leaders from France, Italy, Germany, the Low Countries, had been invited. This meeting took place in Santa Barbara, California, at the Center for the Study of Democratic Institutions. And the purpose of it was to give these young people a chance to a forum in which to express their views and to state what they were trying to do. In a lull between conferences, I was speaking informally with some of these students, and I introduced myself as a monk, and one of the French revolutionary student leaders immediately said, "We are monks also." This was to seem to me to be a very interesting and important statement, and it had all kinds of interesting implications. And one of the interesting implications to me was a sort of an undertone of suggestion that perhaps he was saying, "We are the true monks. You are not the true monks. We are the true monks." The monk is essentially someone who takes up a critical attitude toward the world and its structures. Just as these students identify themselves essentially as people who have taken up a critical attitude toward the contemporary world and its structures. But the criticism is undoubtedly quite different. However, this student seemed to be alluding to the fact that if one is to call himself in some way or another a monk, he must have in some way or other reached some kind of critical conclusion about the validity of certain claims made by secular society and its structures with regard to the end of man's existence. In other words, the monk is somebody who says, in one way or other, that the claims of the world are fraudulent. Now, this, of course, is a dreadful thing to say, and especially it's being said on TV, but nevertheless, there is something essentially valid in this kind of claim. I think we should say that there has to be a dialectic between world refusal and world acceptance. The world refusal of the monk is something that also looks toward an acceptance of the world that is open to change. In other words, the world refusal of the monk is in view of change. This puts the monk on the same plane with the Marxist, because the Marxist directs a dialectical critique of social structures toward the end of revolutionary change. The difference between the monk and the Marxist is fundamental insofar as the Marxist's view of change is oriented to the change of substructures, economic substructures, and the monk is seeking to change man's consciousness. Permit me then to spell this out a little bit for the information of those who have not been meditating on Marxism recently and who haven't really done much homework on Marxism, which I think would be important for monks. Remember that in Marxist thought, you have the priority of matter. Marxist materialism is a doctrine which insists that everything is grounded in matter, and that the explanation and the understanding of things amounts to an understanding of processes which take their origin in matter and in material elements, so to speak. And I could quote to you the famous statement of Feuerbach, "Man ist, was ist," The second is being with two T's, two S's, and it means man is what he eats. See? In other words, the Marxists, the basic approach to reality which the Marxist takes is that if you want to understand man's predicament in the world, you have to understand the economic processes by which he makes his living. And if you fail to understand these processes, no matter how good your explanations and answers may be, they are wide of the mark. Because ignoring this basic economic substructure, they build something that has no validity on a different approach, which ignores this economic starting point, and becomes what they call a mystification. In these terms, therefore, for Marxism, you have three great sources of mystification, which are religion, philosophy, and politics. A religion and philosophy and politics ignore the economic basis of man's being and so forth, and therefore they are wide of the mark. Now, I was speaking to a Marxist professor about this the other day in Singapore, about this thesis, and asking him what he thought about it, and he said, well, you must be careful to note that for Marx, Marxist thought is not essentially and militantly anti-religious, that is to say, in Marx himself. Marx simply discarded religion as an answer, an honest, sincere attempt to answer certain fundamental questions which had been attempted in the past, had not really fully answered the question, but had been a good attempt, but was now no longer valid. So that the Marxist view of religion, according to this man, was really not that it was something that had to be militantly put down, but something that would disappear by itself as soon as man began to mature. And then, of course, this is tied in with the familiar cliché that we now hear these days about the maturity of man, you see. And Teilhard de Chardin steps into the picture at this particular point and meets Marxism halfway by his scientific approach to man, and he is very well accepted by Marxist thought. Teilhard is the one Christian thinker today who is widely read in Marxist countries, precisely because he moves in the direction of an interpretation which takes matter into account as basic. All right. Now, I don't want to go any further on that, this is just enough to give you some idea of what Marxism says, and of course it's very insufficient. Traditional monasticism faces the same problem of man and his happiness and what his life is for, and approaches it from a different angle. And when I say traditional monasticism now, I mean Buddhist monasticism as well as Christian. Buddhist and Christian monasticism start from the problem inside man himself. Instead of dealing with the external structures of society, they start with man's own consciousness. And both Christianity and Buddhism agree that the root of man's problems is that his consciousness is all fouled up, and that he does not apprehend reality as it fully and really is. That the moment he looks at something, he begins to interpret it in ways which are prejudiced and predetermined to fit a certain wrong picture of the world in which he is, as an individual ego, in the center of things. This is called by Buddhism avidya, or ignorance. And from this basic ignorance, which is our experience of ourselves as absolutely autonomous individual egos, from this basic wrong experience of ourselves comes all the rest. This is the source of all our problems. Christianity says almost exactly the same things in terms of the myth of original sin. I say myth of original sin, not trying to discredit the idea of original sin, but using myth with all the force of the word that has been given to it by scholars like Jung and people of the Jungian school, and those psychologists and patristic scholars who meet, for example, at the Eranos meetings annually in Switzerland, where they understand the vital importance and dynamism of myth as a psychological factor in man's adaptation to reality. So our myth of original sin, as explained, for example, by Saint Bernard, comes very, very close indeed to the Buddhist concept of avidyā. Now, in patristic doctrine and in the teaching of the monastic fathers, you find this very strongly stressed. You find, for example, the Cistercians of the 12th century speaking of a kind of monastic therapy. Adam of Persing has this idea that you come to the monastery to be cured first. The period of monastic formation is a period of cure, of convalescence. And then when one makes one's profession, one has passed through convalescence and is ready to begin to be educated in a new way, the education of the new man. And the whole purpose of the monastic life is teaching men to live by love. And the simple formula, which was so popular in the West, was the Augustinian formula of the translation of cupiditas into caritas, or self-centered love into a outgoing, other-centered love, in the process of which change the individual ego was seen to be illusory and dissolved itself, and in place of this self-centered ego came the Christian person, who was no longer just the individual, but was Christ dwelling in each one. So that in each one of us, the Christian person is that which is fully open to all other persons, because ultimately all other persons are Christ. Now, I don't want to get into this deeply mysterious and mystical doctrine here. I have to keep on the subject of Marxism, but I would just point out that in Marx himself you can see something of this same desire to evolve from cupiditas to caritas when you see the idea of communism, which is a progress from capitalist greed, in their terms, to communist dedication, according to the Marxist formula, in which communism consists in a society where each gives according to his capacity and each receives according to his needs. Now, if you will reflect for 2 seconds on that definition, you will find that's a definition of a monastic community. That is precisely what monastic community life has always attempted to do. And it is my personal opinion that monastic community life is really the only place in which this can be done. It can't be done in communism. It can be done in a monastery. I'm subject to correction on this particular point. This is just a personal idiosyncrasy of mine, perhaps, but that's my belief.
Herbert Marcuse is de nieuwe profeet van de radicale jeugd. De huidige mens, zegt Marcuse, heeft zijn idealen laten terugbrengen tot een maatschappelijk systeem zoals dat nu eenmaal is. Deze theorie van de eendimensionale mens vindt Merton uitermate belangrijk.
We come now to the ideas of Marcuse, and I'm not going to develop him at great length. I will simply recommend quite strongly that you make yourselves acquainted in one way or other with Marcuse's very important book, One-Dimensional Man. Now, this book is much more important for the West than it is for the East, but I still think it has considerable importance even in the East, because Marcuse's theory is that all highly organized technological societies as we have them now, or the so-called managerial societies, as found both in the United States and in the Soviet Union, end up by being equally totalitarian in one way or the other. Marcuse's thesis is that the society of the United States of America is just as totalitarian as the society of Russia, the only difference being that the totalitarianism is benign and benevolent and smooth and sweet, whereas that in Russia is a little bit tougher. And Marcuse, I'm not preaching this, I'm just giving you the stuff. This is what the man says, although I must admit that I agree with it to some extent. Marcuse and the students who are revolting in the universities contends that in fact significant choices are no longer able to be made in the kind of organized society that you have either under capitalism or under Soviet socialism. The choices that are really important have all been made before you get around to trying it yourself. The choices that are left to us are insignificant choices, like the choice between which toothpaste I'll use, which airline I'll take, what time I'll go from Bangkok to Hong Kong, or what time I'll go from Bangkok to San Francisco, whether I go Tuesday or Wednesday, or whether I go this week or next week. But these, as far as Marcuse is concerned, are not significant choices. I won't elaborate on this, but there is something to be said for his statement, and it has also been made, incidentally, by a thinker called Eric Fromm, whom you ought to know, in works like Escape from Freedom, The Sane Society, and things like that, which are now quite dated, but nevertheless still have their validity. Eric Fromm is an American psychoanalyst living in Mexico who has gone deeply into the idea of alienation in modern society. The idea of alienation is basically Marxist, and what it means is that man, living under certain economic conditions, is no longer in possession of the fruits of his life. His life is not his. His life is lived according to conditions determined by somebody else. And I would say that on this particular point, which is very important indeed in the early Marx, you have a basically Christian idea. Christianity is against alienation. Christianity revolts against an alienated life. The whole New Testament is, in fact, can be read by a Marxist-oriented mind as a protest against religious alienation. St. Paul is without doubt one of the greatest attackers of religious alienation. Alienation is the theme of the epistle to the Romans and the epistle to the Galatians, and it is something worth knowing about. And in the monastic life, it is extremely important that we take account of this concept, because in fact, we have to face with sorrow the bitter truth that the life of many monks and many dedicated women and many dedicated people is a life of total alienation, in the sense that it is a legal surrender of things which perhaps they should not have surrendered, and a failure to fulfill potentialities which the monastery should allow them to fulfill. Now, this is an enormous problem. But on this point, we have to come together with the Marxists and admit that there is something to be done about it.
Het is beslist niet eenvoudig de functie te zien van de monnik in de moderne samenleving. Merton dacht daar veel over na. In Tibet had hij hierover zeer vruchtbare gesprekken met boeddhistische monniken en daarna met de naar India gevluchte Dalai Lama.
I will pass on now to something that might be more interesting to you. Some conversations that I had with Tibetan monks who have gone through the experience of being thrown out of their country, driven out of their country by communism. First of all, I spoke of this to the Dalai Lama, and I asked his ideas on this whole question of Marxism and monasticism. And I suppose there are few people in the world more intimately involved in this question than the Dalai Lama, who is the religious head of an essentially monastic society. First of all, the Dalai Lama is very objective and open about this kind of thing. He is in no way whatever a fanatical anti-communist. He is an open-minded, reasonable man thinking in terms of a religious tradition. He obviously recognized the problem of a ruthless communist takeover, a power move that had to get rid of monks, that had to drive monks out of Tibet. The Dalai Lama himself made every effort to coexist with communism, and he failed. And he said, frankly, from now on, brother, everybody stands on his own feet. To my mind, that is an extremely important monastic statement. It is, if you forget everything else that has been said, I would suggest you remember this for the future. From now on, everybody stands on his own feet. This, I think, is what Buddhism is about, what Christianity is about, what monasticism is about, if you understand it in terms of grace. That is to say, it's not a Pelagian statement by any means, but it is a statement to the effect that we can no longer rely on being supported, and we should do the best we can with them, but they may be taken away. And if everything is taken away, what do you do next? When the monk begs from the layman and receives a gift from the layman, it is not as a selfish person getting something from somebody else. He is simply opening himself in this interdependence, this mutual interdependence, in which they all recognize that they are immersed in illusion together, but that the illusion is also an empirical reality that has to be fully accepted, and that in this illusion, which is nevertheless empirically real, nirvana is present. And it is all there, if you but see it. I think, by way of closing, that this kind of view of reality is essentially very close to the Christian monastic view of reality. It is the view that if you once penetrate by detachment and purity of heart to the inner secret of the ground of one's ordinary experience, you attain to a liberty which nobody can touch, which nobody can affect, which no political change of circumstances can do anything to. I admit this is a little bit idealistic. I have not attempted to see how this works in a concentration camp, and I hope I don't have the opportunity. But I'm just saying that somewhere behind our monasticism and behind Buddhist monasticism is the belief that this kind of freedom and transcendence are somehow attainable. The essential thing for this in the Buddhist tradition and in our tradition is the formation of spiritual masters who can bring this out in the hearts of people who are as yet unformed. Wherever you have somebody capable of giving some kind of direction and instruction to a small group attempting to do this thing and attempting to love and serve God and reach union with Him, you are bound to have some kind of monasticism. This kind of monasticism cannot be extinguished. It is imperishable. It represents an instinct of the human heart, and it represents a charism given by God to man. It cannot be rooted out, because it does not depend on man, and it does not depend on cultural factors, and it does not depend on sociological or psychological factors. It is something much deeper. I, as a monk, and I think you as monks, can agree that we believe this to be the deepest and most essential thing in our lives. And because we believe this, we have given ourselves to the kind of life we have adopted, and I believe that our renewal consists precisely in deepening this understanding and this grasp of that which is most real. And I believe that by openness to Buddhism, to Hinduism, and to these great Asian traditions, we stand a wonderful chance of learning more about the potentiality of our own traditions, because they have gone, from the natural point of view, so much deeper into this than we have. The combination of the natural techniques and the graces and the other things which have been manifested in Asia and the Christian liberty of the gospel should bring us all at last to that full and transcendent liberty which is beyond mere cultural differences and mere external and mere this and that. So I will conclude on that note. I believe the plan is to have all the questions for this morning's conferences this evening at the panel. So I will disappear from view and we can all have a Coke or something. Thank you very much.
Om 12:30 ochtends beëindigde Merton zijn lezing op de hem eigen manier. 3 uren later stierf hij, waarschijnlijk aan een hartverlamming. Dit is het allerlaatste filmshot van hem.
O God, Master of the world, Father of us all gathered here, in your great kindness, you have looked down on our brother, and you have taken him to enjoy the vision of your beauty. Give us faith, Lord God, Master of the universe, and you, O Brother Thomas, you who are now so close to God, you who see him as he really is, or if you please, just give us something of that, let us share in something of that beauty which you now contemplate forever. God our Father, we thank you for this great grace which you have given to our brother and to us all. In the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, the firstborn among the dead.
Amen.
I think this talk demonstrates, if nothing else, how Merton is all over the place. He's in many ballparks all at once. Some of his former novices remarked that their heads used to swim when they came out of Merton's lectures because there were so many references and he was always urging them to read this and to read that. So before we continue, any questions or comments about the film?
I don't know if you can answer this quickly, and maybe you can answer it privately later. But I noticed that he used the male vocabulary, man, when he's referring to communism and so on. Where, if you could speculate, do you think his vocabulary might change in terms of today's feminist revolution? Do you think he would be in the forefront?
Oh yes, I think he would have come. He was already beginning in some ways to come to inclusive language, which in 1968 was rather early to be doing that. Oh yes, I think he would be using inclusive language at this point in time. I think he probably would write about 3 prose poems pointing out the points where it might be absurd, you know, which we could all laugh at and, you know, agree with. But I think, yes, he would have come to inclusive language. And I should say that anyway, I think Merton was coming to, 10 years before he died, he had already written his meditation on, how do I want to say this? It was called Hagia Sophia. And in this, it was a meditation on the feminine principle in the universe, on God as wisdom, and on wisdom as feminine. So that, you know, almost 30 years before the point where we are now, Merton was already moving in that direction. Yes?
Among all his quotes, I kept hoping for more from the scriptures. What place did he put the scriptures in his thoughts,
in his writing? He always included the scriptures. As you saw, there's suddenly that tie-in with St. Paul. You know, he may have been going through Karl Marx and Erich Fromm and these other people, but all of a sudden, I think he jolts us back to the fact that he's very much based in the scriptures. And he used them quite a bit. In many of his writings, Thoughts in Solitude, The New Man, and so forth, you'll have actual references to the scriptures, which support the things that he is saying. Okay. Any other?
The whole thing through this whole week of these things, it amazes me what a liberal outlook he had within the confines of the most conservative of the Catholic places. I mean, what could be a tighter law than monasticism?
Right, yeah. Except I think he broke out of that and took monasticism in a new direction. I've talked to several people this week who feel that Roman Catholicism, more than other Christian sects, somehow can include people who are off in different directions. Because for some strange reason, maybe it's because they still view themselves as the Catholic Church, the universal church, which means that everybody is supposed to belong to that church, therefore everybody in some way should be included. So they can have right-wingers, left-wingers, you know, people in very mixed bags. And although the Catholic Church at times didn't know what to do with Thomas Merton, there was never an outright rejection of him and his thinking. And as I said, a lot of his things, the Bishop's Pastoral in 1983, reads like a gloss on Thomas Merton. I think his impact on monasticism in the 20th century was, of course, tremendous. Well, I'd like to talk just briefly about why Thomas Merton was interested in the East, why he felt the Buddhist traditions could, Buddhist and Hindu and Islamic traditions could help us to enrich our own traditions. I think at base he felt that in the West, probably from the 18th century onward, the increasing emphasis in our culture and society on technology and materialism had taken us very far away from our spiritual roots. That, as he says in this particular talk, we are very often alienated from the ground of our being, from knowing our real selves, that many of the things that happen to us, we allow ourselves not so much to proceed from what we feel inside as to let outside forces and structures shape our thinking and our lives. And he felt that, perhaps somewhat idealistically, that this had not happened so much in the East. where they had stuck perhaps closer to their spiritual roots. And part of Thomas Merton's continuing journey, he described as a journey to find the real self. And through the finding of our real self, then ultimately to try to discover God as coming through ourselves and through all creation. And he also felt that some of the Eastern traditions had remained closer to that than we had in the West. It's also true that Thomas Merton himself, in the Christian tradition, had always had a predilection for a peculiar way of seeking to find the divinity, which comes much closer to some of the Eastern ways of attempting to explain existence and to deal with existence. Even in the 1940s, Merton was already much interested in what is called the apophatic tradition, as opposed to the cataphatic tradition.
Apophatic is spelled with only one T?
Apophatic. Apophatic. Tradition, which is the way followed by Christian mystics like St. John of the Cross, Juan de la Cruz, Teresa of Avila, even St. Francis of Assisi. A way of seeking to know God through not knowing, where you don't attempt to explain the deity, where if you attempt even to assign attributes to the deity, you've already missed what it is you're trying to attain. The apophatic tradition is often called the dark way of Christianity, where there are things that we can't explain, where we simply know that something is true or real, and yet we can give no logical or reasonable explanation for it. In this tradition, of course, you don't use a lot of words, because if you try to explain it, then, as I say, you already have missed the point. There's a contradiction in Thomas Merton, because, of course, he turned out reams and reams of paper and millions of words. Some of it explaining coming from Tao, the way, where one of the main proverbs is, if you try to explain the Tao, you've already missed the Tao. And so this made, I think, a great appeal to Thomas Merton. Ultimately, in his own life, he came not to feel that one has to separate one's attempt to know God from one's life. Although he always remained very devoted to the Roman Catholic liturgy and to the daily mass that he as a priest said, he felt that our entire life has to be part of this finding of our real self, a part of our seeking God, a part of our prayer. And in fact, he said in one of his journals in 1965, "How I meditate is live, how I pray is breathe." And this comes much closer to some of the Eastern concepts, who see it as a process totally integrated into one's life. You know, we can't just go to church on Sunday morning. We can't just go to Vespers at Holden Village at 8 o'clock in the evening and think that we are trying to find God, or think that we are meditating or praying, just in those little time slots. It has to be integrated into our entire life. And further, we have to see God coming at us in everything. And that means not only in God's creation, where Merton certainly came close to and embraced, in fact, I think, part of the Shinto concept, that we have to see God in everything, no matter how insignificant it may be to us. The word kami, K-A-M-I, in Japanese, has usually been translated as God. You probably know it in the term kamikaze, wind of the gods. And yet, the term kami in Japanese doesn't come close to our Christian conception of God as an omnipotent, omniscient being, because everything has kami. So when you use the word kami, you're not talking about God, you're talking about God in everything, the spirit of God in everything. I could talk about the kami of this rock, or the kami of a blade of grass. And Merton moved in his thinking closer to this conception. And as we move through our daily life, which is our prayer, we have to be able to see this kami coming through to us in everything. He expressed this in various ways. In, I think, perhaps his greatest talk, which he gave to the novices when he retired to the hermitage and retired as novice master in 1965. He used a line which I like very much in talking to the novices about a problem they had been having at the abbey with the rabbits coming in and eating in their garden. And there had been a lot of controversy, apparently, in chapter. Some people wanting to poison the rabbits, others wanting someone to, or something out there, to kind of chase the rabbits away. What caused Merton then to deal with this particular subject was that he felt even in a monastery we could get all heated up, as he called it, over some of the most trivial subjects. You know, here in their chapter, they had been spending all this time talking about rabbits and how to keep the rabbits from eating the lettuce in the garden. And Merton's line is, let's forget about dealing with the rabbits. Just let the rabbits be rabbits. That's what God intended rabbits to be. And if we can just allow the rabbitness of God to show through, as he put it, in all these damn rabbits, then we have come closer to knowing what God is. And I've always liked that term, the rabbitness of God, because I think it sums up, in a way, Thomas Merton's later thought. He knew and studied a great deal about various ways of meditation, even drug-induced meditation, which he never tried, but he looked into it, and he thought that probably there was no such thing as drug-induced meditation. He has one essay called Psychedelic Spirituality, in which he deals with this topic, and he himself could not see that, like TM and some of the other forms of meditation that we have now, where you concentrate on a phrase or an object, quite captured it. Those of you who saw the documentary, remember he was talking about Teresa of Avila, whose major way of meditation was always thinking of Jesus actually as a little teeny person in her heart. And Merton rather rejects that kind of notion. And I'd like to share with you here, as we get to the close, what he said about his own method of meditation, by which I think he meant also his method of prayer. This is a letter he wrote in 1966 to a Muslim, Abdulaziz, in Karachi, Pakistan. Now you ask about my method of meditation. Strictly speaking, I have a very simple way of prayer. It is centered entirely on attention to the presence of God and to His will and His love. That is to say that it is centered on faith, by which alone we can know the presence of God. One might say this gives my meditation the character described by the prophet, Muhammad, as being before God as if you saw Him. Yet it does not mean imagining anything or conceiving a precise image of God, for to my mind, this would be a kind of idolatry. On the contrary, it is a matter of adoring Him as invisible and infinitely beyond our comprehension, and realizing Him as all. My prayer tends very much toward what you call fana. There is in my heart this great thirst to recognize totally the nothingness of all that is not God. My prayer is then a kind of praise rising up out of the center of nothing and silence. If I am still present myself, this I recognize as an obstacle about which I can do nothing unless He Himself removes the obstacle. If He wills, He can then make the nothingness into a total clarity. If He does not will, then the nothingness seems to itself to be an object and remains an obstacle. Such is my ordinary way of prayer or meditation. It is not thinking about anything, but a direct seeking of the face of the invisible, which cannot be found unless we become lost in Him who is invisible. I do not ordinarily write about such things, and I ask you therefore to be discreet about it. But I write this as a testimony of confidence and friendship. It will show you how much I appreciate the tradition of Sufism. Let us therefore adore and praise God, and pray to Him for the world, which is in great trouble and confusion. I am united with you in prayer during this month of Ramadan, and will remember you on the night of destiny. I appreciate your prayers for me. May the Most High God send His blessing upon you and give you peace.
He has trouble living in an exclusive world, doesn't he? Where he shuts the other folks out, away from God.
Yes. There is ultimately nothing exclusionist about Thomas Merton's religion. Although he, I think, remains true to his own tradition and feels that for him that is the only way.
I'd sure like to read something he might write about today's television preachers.
Well, he didn't like television anyway. He felt it was the great opiate. He did not, well, of course, they weren't around, as there were some. But he doesn't have much to say about that kind of thing. One does wonder how he would deal with it. I think, first of all, he would find a certain validity because, after all, we all find our own way to God. And if that is helping people somehow to get to the ground of their being and ultimately to see, as he calls it, the face of the invisible, you can't very well knock it in his terms.
Is there a
common
television?
Yes, I suppose so, at least in those things in the television set, which come from God's creation. But what we may get from that kami that has been used by man is probably man's creation, I would say.
So there is ultimately a separation between what is kami and what is something other. Just because it exists doesn't necessarily mean that in that entity there is a kami.
Right. I would say that we may often pervert kami.
There's a kami of nuclear energy, but not necessarily a kami of a nuclear bomb.
Right. Yeah. Or to put it in much more mundane terms, you know, there is a kami to the kaku in my shirt, but not necessarily to the shirt that someone made out of that kami. And that's one of the things that gets wrong when we pervert God's creation.
I don't really understand. You're saying we can pervert the kami?
I think man can, yes, can take God's creation, can't they? And use it for all the wrong reasons. You know, where we have trashed up the earth, where we have polluted rivers and streams, those rivers, those streams, those lakes still have kami. They are still a part of God's creation, but God hasn't made them icky and horrible. We have. Right?
Let me think about it a while.
Okay.
Quote my daughter at age 3, Daddy, why did God make slugs?
Can we say that God
is a kami in everything?
Yes.
Did God create, or did God create
even in the slug?
Talk to Dale, because he feels that the next revolution is going to be from the banana slugs, that they really have not the respect that they deserve.
Well, thank you. I've enjoyed this.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.